Welcome to the Matt Morgan Coaching Podcast. The fact that you're listening means you're ready to be inspired and empowered to take your life, love, and leadership to the next level.
All right, today we are talking about Enneagram Type 1, and I have with me my dear friend and amazing mother, incredible wife, and an amazing friend to both Sarah and I, and fashionista, designer extraordinaire, Kristen McGuire. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Kristen is a one, and we're going to hear all about, you know, her type oneness. And but before we do, those of you who think you're a one or are related to one or married to one, listen up, because this is some tendencies to Enneagram Type 1. Here we go. Number one, people have told me that I can be overly judgmental or critical. Number two, I beat myself up when I make mistakes. I don't feel comfortable when I try to relax. There's too much to be done. I don't like it when people ignore or break the rules. Details, they matter. I often find that I compare myself to others. If I say I'll do it, I'll do it. It's hard for me to let go of resentment. I think it's my responsibility to leave the world better than I found it. I got a lot of self-discipline. Nobody needs to try to get more of that from me. I try to be careful and thoughtful about how I spend money. It seems to be that things are either right or wrong, black or white, good or bad. I spend a lot of time on how I can be a better person. Forgiveness? Now, that's pretty hard for me. I notice immediately when things are wrong or out of place. I worry a lot. It really frustrates me when other people don't do their part. I like routine and don't readily embrace change. I do my best when working on a project, and I wish others would do the same so I wouldn't have to do and redo their work. I often feel like I try harder than others to do things correctly. Now, that's just a few behavioral tendencies of type one. But as we've been talking and as we've been learning, how you find your number is less about behavior, although that's all very important. It's more about core motivation. Why we do what we do is way more intriguing than your behavior. And the core motivation of type one is to be right, or to be good, or to be virtuous. And so some are perfectionists, some are reformers, some are judges, some are critics, but at the end of the day, to be right or to be good, or to be virtuous, that's what really matters. And so Kristen, I'm kind of curious for you, when you first took Enneagram Type 1, what parts of Type 1 really jumped out and grabbed you and resonated with you?
All of them. Literally all of those that you just listed, I not necessarily currently in my life, but over the course of time, especially when I was younger, yes to all in some form or fashion.
I love that you said that. Those of you who are listening to, it's really important. You really will find these types in your life that really at a bigger level in your early 20s. I think as we get older in our 40s, 50s, and that kind of stuff, our give a shit meter goes down a little bit.
Yes.
So, and hopefully we become a healthier version of ourselves. But any particular behaviors in there that really jump out at you that you're like, that is so me, even today?
Not necessarily today, but definitely some today. I have always been a rule follower. And it really comes out when I'm driving or encountering drivers that are not following the rules, and it makes me crazy. And it's so funny to look at some of these, because it's about partially also rolls back into control.
Yeah.
For me a bit.
Yeah.
And I think especially forgiveness when I was younger. Mm. I mean, I would just, if you crossed me and I'm out. There was really not a lot of, I guess, give and take. It was a one and done, maybe a second chance here and there. But if a friend crossed me, I'd be like, well, moving along.
Okay, that is huge. And I would imagine that if you're listening to this and you're a one, or you're related to one, or getting married to one, that is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Ones live in the world of expectation. There's a right way and a wrong way to do things. And so if a friend or someone doesn't do what's expected of them, even when it was clear and crosses you even multiple times, a one will cut you out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can look back and see the error of my ways, and am a much, I mean, I'm 50. So there is a drastic difference between 20 and 50 and the changes and the life experiences that we go through that start to throw shade on us in a sense and make you, or have you have the opportunity to self-reflect and to improve upon yourself. I mean, I know that's one of them that's also listed. And as to not become almost obsessed with self-improvement either, but we all have things and areas and weaknesses that have room for improvement. And I'm not going to say has been easy, but the reflection is pretty mind blowing to look back at this list and go, wow, I have encountered every single one of those over the course of my life. But I would say almost in a, not that I don't have a tendency to go there, but I can, it's not self-restraint. I don't actually live for the most part in black and white as much anymore. And maybe that's children buffering off those hard edges. I see a lot of gray now. A lot.
That is a healthy one.
Yeah.
That there is shades of gray. You know, there's lots of nuance and understanding that life doesn't always have to be black and white. And so that's very healthy and a good lesson for us who are still living in the black and white world to learn. How do we do that? We're going to explore that, you know, as we go further. But I'm kind of curious to start, like, what aspects of type one do you love and you celebrate?
I mean, attention to detail. I love that. I mean, and maybe that's just comes from more of my creative side, where if it applies to fashion, if it applies to my home, my space, if you're planning an event or something like that. However, I've gotten much more laissez-faire even on that, to know that sometimes this doesn't have to be just like this for people to have fun, because not everybody is going to even notice that.
Yeah.
And I am allowing some space there between perfection and good enough.
Oh, that is a really good, healthy move as well. Perfection is a big deal. Perfection is something that none of us can actually sustain.
Oh, it's impossible.
It is impossible. And so I love that. That's such a healthy thing. I hope you guys listen to that. There is, I think, a great, healthy next step is moving from the idea of perfection to excellence. Mm-hmm. Excellence still says, I'm going to try my best. But there's also, it's okay for things to not be okay.
Well, and the realization for me that sometimes even when I do my best, it's not perfect. And that is the best I have to offer. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I feel like we've given the phrase good enough some negative connotation. And I actually feel like there's some positive in there for a number of people. I mean, even people that don't struggle with perfection, is that it's an acceptance of ourselves and the fact that we are not perfect and we will never be perfect. And it takes, it's actually the ability to take the pressure off oneself. At least this is how, for me, that feels, is that that is actually good enough.
You know, this is really powerful. Two things, two thoughts. Number one, one of the things that I love most about type ones is they're some of the most reliable people on the planet. When they say they're going to do something, they're going to do something. They're going to be there. And they show up when other people might flake out. And they do understand the details. And so the second thing that is really interesting, what you were just talking about, is I'm a 3 on the Enneagram. And 3s actually do, and sometimes in a flaw, say it's good enough. And so in the spirit of efficiency, sometimes we miss effective, and 1s are really good for 3s because you're like, wait, you didn't cross that T and dot that I, and that matters. That 20% is actually 80% of the effectiveness, and you've missed it. And yet on the flip side, sometimes threes are really good for ones because we're like, hey, listen, you got the 80%. It really is good enough.
Yes.
And if you spend 80% of your time on 20% of the effectiveness of crossing that T and dotting the I, you're just wasting time and energy and causing more stress for you. Knowing the difference, that's definitely an art to develop.
And I'm not always successful at it. And I'm married to a three.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to hear you say that, because my husband, he will do things faster than me, or and in some instances it is okay, and in some it's not. And then to your point with me, he will say, you can probably let that go. Like, it looks great, or whatever it happens to be. Yeah. So it's really interesting to, I think it's partially being able to, I don't know how to say it, to remove so much, not ownership, but remove so much, like, maybe it's the control, it's the grasp and like holding on so tight. And you can view it as a negative when your partner doesn't understand, but you can also look at it as an opportunity to learn about what actually is possible.
Yeah. I wonder for some, if it's not perfect, then that's a reflection on me as a person, that then I'm bad or I'm not good.
Or deriving value from always being perfect, doing what's expected of you. And that becomes exhausting.
Absolutely.
Mentally, physically, emotionally, all the things.
Yeah. So leaving room, a space between excellence and perfection, that is an interesting next step for a lot of ones to grow in healthiness with that and say, it is okay. This is enough. Mm-hmm. And so I need to listen to someone else and be like, it's good enough. Like, that's fine. Let's move on. And then other times that's your superpower. No, to be like, no, we actually really need to lean in right now and to fight for that. That is definitely a skill to learn. You know, one of the things that's interesting about ones is that they're in, so there's something called triads. There's nine normal types. And so within each type, the eight, nine, and the one are in what's called the gut or anger triad. And the gut is something where eight, nines, and ones all make decisions somatically. They actually feel things and get a gut instinct about people or an environment from a gut level. What's interesting about a one is that they're a little bit different, because they actually have a gut instinct of what's right or what's good or what's best, but sometimes they don't always trust their gut. And so while some people are ready, fire, aim, like me as a three, sometimes I can go 0 to 60, but I'm just going the wrong way.
Right.
One sometimes are ready, aim, aim, aim. And some people are like, fire, damn it, let's go. Like, let's move forward, because they want to make sure that their gut is actually correct. So they do a lot of data, a lot of information, a lot of like five behavior of like making sure they're doing the research, and maybe a lot of six of worry of whether or not they are making the best choice. And so now I usually say that healthy ones or anyone do really well with healthy eights in their life, because an eight gets it. They kind of get a somatic thing of like, hey, what's your gut say? And a one can say maybe that. And so it's like, well, look, go with that one, 'cause it's probably right. Ones. And if, you know, those of you who are married to a one, you don't always like to hear this, ones usually are right.
Yes.
Nine times out of 10, they are right. And so it really is like, what's your gut say? Let's go with that. And you can make faster decisions. How does that resonate with you?
It does. It's interesting. I don't know where this part comes from for me, is that I actually make decisions relatively quickly on, I would say it's an 80-20. 80% of things, because it's my gut, and I cannot disassociate. When I am super nervous or under an extreme amount of stress, it hits me in my solar plexus. Mm. So I can't eat very much. Mm. And so I have been, for the most part, unable to override that. There have absolutely been times in my life, certainly when I was younger, where I didn't listen to it. But that's one area that I feel like I've generally stayed very in touch with and can move on decisions. Again, there's an exception to every rule, and certain, sometimes when it's a bigger life choice or things, sometimes maybe involving kids or just, you know, where there's so much nuance, and it not only affects me, but it affects so my children, my husband, whatever.
Yeah.
But I definitely feel that in my soul, because I am very intuitive, and I have learned to definitely listen to it. It doesn't mean that I'm not sometimes wrong. I hate admitting that. It doesn't mean that I've always made the right or the correct decision, but most times I do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think the more you get rid of perfection and adopt excellence, you're freed up to make decisions a little bit quicker.
Yes.
Because your identity doesn't ride on failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a powerful thing. Failing doesn't make you a failure. And if you can realize that gift, you are able to move forward a little bit faster, which sounds like you are. But it's not always easy to do that. And,
I worry. I the caveat, because you said that part towards the end of that description, I will still make a decision, whether it's not that if it's this, did I order this brick correctly for the exterior of my home? And oh my gosh, this can financially, if I was off on my measurements kind of thing. But then I also, that seems trivial when we're talking about, I'm talking about raising children and when you're making choices, especially when they're in their teenage years and those kind of things where I worry.
Yeah.
And that I have only more recently started to slowly, and I use the word slowly very definitively there, make some strides to, you know, that goes back to my faith and developing trust and allowing things to happen and starting to relinquish some control.
What does that voice of worry say to you? Is there a resounding gong or statement?
It's it generally will go to a worst case scenario. In any situation, my brain can get to picture what the worst case scenario is.
Yeah.
And I'm really starting to revert to whenever I start to get those pictures of worst case scenario, of I am like to myself out loud as well as in my head voice, what if it works out? And that is starting to help me, and also my oldest daughter, who I believe is a one. Because she learns by watching me, and she is a lot like me. And I see her struggling. And I think part of the impetus to this has been your children will reflect a lot onto you in the sense of what you can see clearly.
Yeah.
Sometimes the error of your ways.
Yes.
That, or not error, but just that maybe that's not the healthiest expression. And that is one thing where, because she will go to worst case scenario and exactly like me, and I can see it, and it makes my heart hurt. It makes me, because I'm like, oh no, I don't want her to struggle with that. Like, of course not. Right.
Right.
And so what if it works out? And I literally sometimes in certain situations, I just have to repeat it over and over again.
And does that help?
It does. Good. Because I'm focusing on the positive. I'm speaking positive to my brain.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing, because I know a lot of ones, twos, and this is a big thing for sixes. They all feel that. And sometimes they say what's not helpful is when somebody says, just don't worry about it. It's like the least helpful thing to do. And oftentimes if your brain's going from A to Z, the worst possible thing is Z. I always tell people, well, let's just go ahead and look at Z and say, if Z were to happen, would you still be okay?
Right.
And 9.9 times out of 10, the answer is yeah. I may not be happy emotionally.
It might be hard.
It might be hard, but I will be okay. We'll land on our feet. It will be okay.
Yes.
And that's a really, I think, comforting thing sometimes. So like, let's not try to avoid it. Let's look right at it. But then also to have the positives, like you just said, is powerful. You know, one of the things that I said in that triad, not only is the gut thing of making decisions, but also the anger thing. Eights externalize their anger. they get like a lion. Nines fall asleep to their anger because they want peace.
Interesting.
And
yes.
so, and if they're angry, that is, creates conflict, and they don't want conflict. So they just subvert their anger and fall asleep to it. And so where ones, a lot of ones, it's a smoldering anger. One, so much live in the world of expectation that there's a right and wrong way to do things, that when you cross that, as we just talked about with relationships earlier, there is anger. And this goes into what's called the shadow side. Every number has a superpower, which, being the most reliable people on the planet, being detail-oriented people, being good and virtuous and right and making the world a better place, all amazing superpowers of type one. But the shadow side is, in fact, anger. But anger, when it goes undealt with, it can turn into bitterness. And bitterness, when it goes undealt with, it turns into resentment. And resentment that goes undealt with turns into contempt. And contempt is the place of moral superiority over another person, where you're like, you know what? You could blow up or stuff it. I don't care. You're dead to me. And that's
yes,
where
and
they
I've
blend
been
that
there.
Up. Yeah. And everyone was like, oh, yeah, I've been there too. That's that anger side for us. And so it's really interesting in relationships, because relationships, people who are married to a one or dating a one or connected to a one, they say, you know, sometimes what's difficult about being related to a one is that when they walk into a room, they seem to notice what's out of place, what's wrong. And so the one comes in and they're like, hey, you forgot to do this, or hey, you didn't do that. And the person, the child or the you know, significant other is like, well, did you see the other 8 things that I did right?
Right.
And it's not that the one didn't see it. It's just that they so live in the world of expectation that if it was expected, I don't say it. And so they only talk about what's out of place. And that's frustrating. And then when someone tells a one that, like, hey, can't you just acknowledge what I did right? Ones, on the flip side, don't always like to have constructive criticism back to them. And here's why. Ones are thinking, are you kidding me? You think I'm coming down on you? I'm not. You have no idea how much I come down on myself. Mm-hmm. The anger that a lot of ones say they feel is actually less toward others, although it is, and tenfold on themselves. If a one screws up, many ones say they just rake themselves over the coals. How could I be so stupid? What were you thinking? How could you be such an idiot? How could you not see that? How does that impact you? Your own self-criticism, has that ever impacted you, as so many ones say?
Oh, absolutely. I would say this is one of the arenas where I'm still working very hard on it. I have made massive strides, but it's hard for me, admittedly. And I think maybe part of it is on parenting. If you take it specifically, if you verbalize expectations or there's a list and you come in and okay, fine, 8 out of 10 of them are done, but you're not dealing with a toddler at this point, and the one, like the blatantly obvious thing is still sitting there undone. My brain just does not understand. You walked in here and you thought this was fine. Like, how did you not see this?
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I've really had to work very hard with my kids as well as with my husband to say, thank you for doing the other things. Thank you for, and actually not even the other things. Thank you for what you did. Hey, and then sometimes I'll have to say that and step away and say, oh, I noticed that this didn't get done. Would you mind going ahead and finishing that too?
Oh, what a great, okay. Lean into what she just said. The starting point is starting with gratitude. It's got to be genuine gratitude. You saw the expectation. You saw what was right. But if you see it, say it.
Yes.
And if you start with that, that creates an opportunity and a window for people to hear and not feel blamed or ridiculed or criticized for the parts they didn't do, because they see that, wow, you acknowledge the 8 things I did.
Right.
And I think there's another benefit that comes relationally. It starts to show people that I love you as you are.
And you, we all still have room for improvement.
Yeah.
That's what I say to my kids. You are perfect just as you are. And there's nothing wrong with trying to improve yourself.
Mm-hmm. There's not. And that is one of the great things about a one. Every strength can become its greatest weakness when it goes too far. And so some ones in relationship, when they're average ones, they can be judgmental or seem critical. And so what their spouse or child or friend hears is, you're not enough because you could always keep doing more. And that's why it's so powerful. I love what you said. You are loved as you are.
Yes.
Please hear that first part. That's the grace that you need to hear. The truth is we can all get better.
Right.
We need it in that order.
I have chosen also, I have to speak very slowly when I'm, especially with my kids, when I'm doing this, because I have started to replace the word but with and.
Huge.
I love you. And could you go ahead and do that for me? Or, I mean, that's not necessarily the sentence, but it's what I'm trying to communicate.
That is so good. But it nullifies.
Correct. It nullifies the prior. I love you conditionally on this thing not be right.
Yeah.
So, I can see in my kids just a tiny bit of their, especially my youngest daughter. I can see that she's noting that I'm saying, and it's very, very slow that we're starting to work on this together. Cause it's what her shortcomings are. I mean, and this is a hard thing, I think, as a parent and as a one parent, is her shortcomings. Just like I was saying, my older daughter is taking on things that she's seen me do. And because she just happens to be a one, my younger daughter is a lot more reflecting my shadow side. Not that the older one isn't, but you understand what I'm saying. It's definitely, it's almost harsher because she is more different than me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we know what she is. I don't know if we've ever had her do that or not. I can't think of what she is, what number she is, but at any rate, I don't know if that makes sense, but, I'm starting to see, I can see her brain acknowledging just the flash in the eye that you see. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's amazing how, and I love that what you're doing is as a parent too, when those of you become parents listening, so much of parenting is caught more than it is taught. Mm-hmm. And that we recognize that we need to understand the bend of our child as well as understand the bend of ourselves in our parenting approach of our strengths and also our shadow side or our weakness coming out and being connected to that. So that's really powerful. You know, I know that everyone has four other numbers that they can connect to. One is what's called your wings, which for a one, there's a 9 or a 2. So that's the wings. A wing is the other numbers on either side of type one. So if you look or do a Google search of the Enneagram, you'll see type 9 and type 2 are on the other side. So some ones have a more peaceful approach to them. Some ones have more of the helper, you know, side to them. And then on the flip side, if you look at the Enneagram, you'll actually see these arrows. When the arrow points away from your number, which for type one, that means you go to type 4, that's where you go in stress. When ones are in stress, they're not doing well. Sometimes they feel like you don't get it. You don't understand. They want to kind of have their own space. They kind of want to go do their own thing. And they can be creative too in that space of a four, but sometimes it's from a place of stress, not in a good spot. And so they can feel emotional or flustered. On the flip side, when the arrow points towards your number, this is where you go in your happy place. And for a one, it's type 7, which is the enthusiast, the life of the party. They want to have fun. That's the core motivation of type 7. And a lot of ones are interesting because they live in the world of to-do lists. There's always a to-do list and it never seems to end.
Ever, 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 ever.
And yet, so going on vacations, some ones say, that's my respite. That's when I can put on my 7 hat. And it's really interesting for ones to say, how often do I live in my happy place and how can I get there more often? How does that impact you?
A lot. That is a very good description of me. I have endless to-do lists. And I do notice that even when I'm always on myself and am short to acknowledge that I got through all of those things. The one or two things, I didn't get those. And so I'm working on that. And it's life is busy for everyone. Yeah. I mean, I think everyone has a constant to-do list. And I am at 50, finally starting to say, the world is not going to fall apart if that doesn't get done.
Mm.
And there are sometimes, I mean, we are adults, we have responsibilities. There's definitely days where maybe three or four things on my list. I have to get these things done today.
Yeah.
And when that, and I do, and of course I do, I'm a one, right? Of course that happens, but letting go of those ones, letting go of the things lower on the list is hard, but I'm going to play golf with my husband, even when I have whatever left to do. It's fantastic, to your point, when I go on vacation and it's very difficult to return because I adjust to doing nothing shockingly quickly. I mean, it's definitely hard. But again, I think more so in a different aspect, as I get older, I can be more present to those moments and acknowledge the beauty in letting go. Mm. But it's not easy.
No, not at all.
Because I think just as sometimes maybe I don't know if this is a three, but people can, their worth is tied up in what they have and what they've done.
Yeah.
I think that for me, at least, sometimes I feel like there is a connection to my worth. And this is definitely more in the past and less now. But my worth was tied up in how neat my home was when someone came over. I mean, and nobody cares. Mm. I mean, and the people, and now the people that would notice that my house might not be perfect would not be people that I would want to be friends with anymore. Because I'm so in a certain sense, I'm exhausted of trying to be perfect.
Wow. What a relinquishing sense of freedom to not have to have that, to be like, you love me for me, not for how clean my house is.
Right. And that's just one of the examples. If it's a wrinkle on my face.
Yeah.
If it's that my fingernails aren't painted, if it's that, I don't know, my car is dirty. I mean, these are all very superficial things, but that's my point, is that the older I get, I'm more in tune to the fact that these are fun things to have or do, but they do not determine my worth.
Well said. That's powerful. You know, within each type, there are these things called subtypes. And it's kind of like a three-layered cake where there's different types of ones. There's a self-preservation, a social, and a sexual. Sexual means like one-on-one relationships. And so the self-preservation is a person who is more concerned about being perfect and not screwing up themselves. They're very focused on like, am I doing right? Am I making sure things are okay? And that is their focus. The social is making sure the world is doing right. And they will tell you if they're not, right? If you park your car and you're not between the lines at the grocery store, and you know, one might just send you a message by parking their car right up against you so you can't even get into your own door from the driver's side, just to teach you, you know, a lesson of how you're supposed to do it, and or driving over the speed limit or whatever it is. Like, these things are really powerful. And then the sexual one is interesting, because while those first two really have a subdued anger when they get mad, the sexual one is actually types and looks a lot more like an eight than any other type. They're okay being more aggressive and more vocal with their anger. They are more reformers than they are even perfectionists. They are wanting to reform their partner, their husband, their wife, their kids. Like, I want you to be the best you can be. And that is their focus. And so, when you look at yourself between those three, maybe you see parts of yourself, which one of those subtypes most resonates with you?
It's the sexual, the reformer. Is that what you call it?
Yeah, the sexual. Yeah, the reformer.
100%. And if I think some of the other two, but I mean, dominant in that space of the reformer, I think I'm one of those people that I generally always see the possibilities. I can, and I get excited. I'm like, oh, but if you did this and you did that and you did this and da 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 da. But people don't feel like that's helpful, I've noticed, even because it feels critical.
Yeah, unless you're connected to my wife, who's an eight, and then you two get up talking about nutrition and health, and it's all day long. How can we get better? What can we do?
Yes.
In fact, the first time I met you, you guys came over to my house, and you actually had a very powerful presence. And I thought you were an eight, you know, because it was just like, whoa, she's like Sarah, like she's got strength in her. And it's like, oh, that's the sexual one. Sexual ones look way more like that eight. They're powerful. They're confident. They know themselves and they're wanting to be the best versions of themselves they can be. And so it seems like you guys have really connected. I'm kind of curious for you, what numbers do you gravitate toward the most in friendship? And then maybe on the flip side, which ones are you repulsed by the most?
I don't know. I'd have to think about, you might have to give me some descriptions to remind me of the, but I have a lot of friends that are eights. I would say my three best friends, my three closest friends are eights. And I can see, I understand why you thought I was an eight, because and maybe this reflects back on, I have no idea, but is there a connection between my sun sign and the fact that I'm a Leo? I mean, there is connection there, as because I've often been told that people get intimidated by me, which is so fascinating to me, because I'm like, I could talk to the wall, right? I mean, I'm just here to chat, right? So that's not shocking that you had that impression, because when I'm comfortable, that is, and I feel kind of like, I think comfortable is the better word, is the appropriate word. When I feel comfortable, that is what I will exude. There are times when I definitely, people who meet me don't get that, but obviously I was comfortable with you and Sarah. I mean, this has been years back, but, and it's continued, but eights and I get along, and I'm less fiery than I used to be, but I can be aggressive. I can appreciate parts of that now, and I have no desire to change some of it. However, some of it, in some, you know, lanes, to use the driving piece, is that some areas could use and have benefited from me stepping off and taking a breath and letting others do what they want to do.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. Those of you who see and identify with Kristen as like a sexual one, eights, threes, sevens, those are typically the ones who are able to interact with you a little bit more because you are more intense or more aggressive just in your demeanor, even if you're not trying to be. You're more intimidating. And so those numbers are ones who can handle that a little bit more. Nines, sensitive twos, they may slink back a little bit. And so it's really important from a relationship perspective to know that if you think you're coming across at a five on an intensity scale, for them, you're like a nine or a 10 on the Richter scale.
Right.
And some ones say that unhealthy sevens can piss them off because they start things and don't finish. They're flaky.
Yes.
They say yes and mean no.
Yes.
And then sometimes really emotional fours, which is kind of where ones go in stress. And so it's like, I don't like me when I'm in stress. And I see that sometimes in others, and they're really moody or emotional. They're not logical or using their brain. Ones can like really use their brain and get logical. And so they see fours as overly emotional, and that bothers them.
I'm okay with four. I mean, like that, but that would be something, and has been in the past, where I'm like, I want people to, okay, let's come back to the critical thinking skills. Let's use the brain. But then what's so funny is I can go to the worst case scenario, which is not necessarily logical either. So again, as I've gotten older, I'm able to appreciate more so where that emotion is coming from. And I think for so many people that it's a feeling of loss of control. I know that's, I'm actively the anger and the loss of, you know, not being able to control as your kids get older and they're driving on their own and all of the things. The loss of control is very difficult for me. So, but again, I'm able now to, and this has taken years of work of being able to look at myself and go, that's not really that great, Kristen. That's not your strong point. And no, and a one does not like admitting that. But interestingly enough for me, again, like the relinquishing of perfectionism, it's tied into that. Saying that and acknowledging that is the freedom. Admitting that I have issues with control. To give you a good example, my husband now understands why I am so scared when he's driving. And he used to, it made him crazy because I would backseat drive.
Yeah.
And now he understands that is actually, it's not because he's a bad driver. It's because I feel completely out of control. And it's very triggering.
Yeah.
And so it's been, and that's just one as that's a really good one since we're, you know, talking about marital relations is that, and by the way, we've been married for 17 years and we just figured that out about 2 months ago. So, but it's interesting because now he doesn't have this, like physical reaction when we go to drive somewhere. And cause I could see he would be like tense.
Yeah.
Why is he so tense? I don't understand. I mean, what's going on? I'm just asking, just drive, right?
Yeah.
And it's because he was anticipating me being hypercritical of him. And he took it as a personal attack. And it wasn't that. Because he hasn't had any accidents. He's not a bad driver. He drives differently than me.
Yeah.
But he's not a bad driver.
You know what I love about this is that when you get to understand someone's core motivation and their shadow sides and the nuance of their inner world, like Zach, your husband, did for you, it really helps give compassion.
Yes.
When maybe otherwise you would give judgment back, and now you're in a full-blown fight.
Yes. In the car. 100%.
And it's like, oh, this is an attack on me. This is, you know, Kristen's control, you know, and it's really tough right now. And that way she would handle it is different the way that I would do it. And I can have compassion for that. And so, you know, or driving a car is one, loading a dishwasher might be another. There was a right way and a wrong way to load the dishwasher. Everyone would say,
correct.
Yeah.
I think back to the driving thing, to reinforce your point is that what it's shown us or him to me is that I'm, oh my gosh, my wife is scared. And do I want to continue doing something that actively scares my wife? Now, does that mean that going 5 miles an hour less, is that big of a deal? This is him talking.
Yeah.
He said this to me. Is that big of a deal? No. And because, by the way, I speed. That is where I'm not a one. I speed. It's just how I don't know. I grew up in the country. Maybe
me
that's
too.
It. I mean, I drive quickly. But is it that big of a deal to slow down? I mean, can we go 85 instead of 90? Right? Or 80 instead of 85? Is it that large of a deal? Realizing that if I do that, it just takes the edge off for my wife.
Yeah.
And I we love each other, and why wouldn't we do those little things to accommodate?
I think the moral of the story for those of us listening is, may we ask our partner the question.
Yeah.
What would make you feel safe?
Very true. Very true.
That would be the good step there to help you out, as opposed to just getting mad. And I've been there firsthand with Sarah as well. And this guy can very much resonate. you know, as we get ready to close out here, this has been super helpful to listen to your story and how the one makes you tick. And again, those of you listening, this is not meant to put you in a box. This is meant to give you language to help yourself and to help others. Awareness is half the battle. But if you would give, if you had one thing to share, if anything, for the rest of us who are not ones, to be able to understand ones, what would be a closing statement that maybe you'd want to share with all of us on behalf of the ones?
I think that, at least for me, that communication is so key. And in marriage, life gets so busy that we can manage through the logistics very well. And it kind of puts this cover over and makes us feel like, oh, everything's going great. But just like what you said earlier, just simply asking the question of what would make you feel safe, that's communication. Mm. That's very direct. And trying to, you may not always fully get to the point of full understanding because you didn't live your spouse's life up until, right? You mm-hmm. didn't live with them
yeah.
or experience things with them. But really making a concerted effort to understand in the realm and in the amount that you possibly can will give you then, it's like the lens to the impetus of why they're doing the thing that they're doing.
Yeah.
Because it's none of it's unrelated.
Yeah.
That was a terrible grammatic sense, but
it's all good.
Right. And it's an opportunity. The communication is an opportunity. It's hard. Or actually, it's simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah. Well said.
But it's well worth the investment of learning how to communicate.
Yeah, and for a lot of ones, what I found in my own experience with ones is, and this is true for any of us, but especially ones, is if you can talk about expectations mm-hmm. before the event occurs, you will save yourself countless hours of needless bickering
yes.
and frustration on both ends.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your story and being vulnerable with us. And you're going to help a lot of us who are ones or connected to ones out. And really appreciate you coming on today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Morgan Coaching Podcast. Subscribe below, share it with your friends. And if you want to take your life, love, or leadership to the next level, check us out online at mattmorgan.com.